Peter, welcome to the show.
Great pleasure, Kathleen.
Coming up this week, among your last concerts with the TSO are performances of Mahler's Ninth Symphony. Now, whenever we've asked TSO musicians, and we have a few times, about their favorite music or personal musical highlights in their careers, Mahler invariably gets mentioned. What is it about his music that gives so much to the people who play it?
Well, Mahler describes the entire world to us. It's not what we might call chemically pure art music, like this is the language and this is what we... He will go anywhere, right? So into the world of folk music, into military fanfares, into the deepest heartfelt, passionate, either pathos or love or whatever. And then into the incredible worlds when you get to the Ninth Symphony of harmonic and melodic daring. I mean, what he does in the Ninth Symphony is really to say, this is saturation. Nothing more in his mind could really be written in what we would call maybe traditional tonality. And it is so raw sometimes. I mean, the third movement is a great example, that insane march. It always reminds me when I'm conducting it of the Große Fuge of Beethoven, mm-hmm. which, you know, Beethoven never actually heard it, but he had a pretty good idea what it sounded like, but it is relentlessly honest to the fugue subject's continuity without any regard for what the actual harmonies might be at any given moment. You have to listen to it all horizontally, because if you just take the sheer harmonies, it is so dissonant. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Stravinsky who said that piece was modern when it was written and will be forever modern. Mm. And the same, I think, can be said especially about the third movement of Mahler 9, which is... so dramatic, and then of course has an incredibly haunting passage where the trumpet reflects. Mahler reminisces in a way that nobody else can, I think. He can take you from a visceral world of action into a world of contemplation and reminiscence that is so touching to us all. And we feel sometimes he uses offstage instruments to do that, like the offstage trumpet in the Third Symphony. But in this case, in the Ninth Symphony, he doesn't do that. And the first movement is so tender. It is so full of the longing for the beauty of life, which had eluded Mahler, generally speaking. His life was a struggle. He was not an easy person. He was a very difficult conductor, a brilliant conductor, but demanding beyond belief. And he had a lot of tragedy in his life. Lost, you know, at the point when he wrote this piece, he had just lost one of his daughters, and terrible, and he'd also found out that he had a heart condition which would make it unlikely for him to live more than just a few more years. So the Ninth Symphony opens the door to the 20th century, without question. It is it invites Schoenberg and any composer you'd like to name. If Mahler can write that, then we can continue in that path. And some people see it as an absolute farewell to the 19th century and to Romanticism. They see it as a farewell from his own life. And they see it also as a depiction of death in the last movement. The last movement is full of alternately impassioned sort of chorales, which are just loving. It's like the sound of love is that music. And then to these very, very abandoned, tragic contrapuntal lines in instruments like the bassoon or even the contrabassoon, leaving one feeling really desolate. And these passages alternate throughout this last movement until you get to the final page, which is one of the most famous pages in music, which is the unraveling, really, of all of this material. A lot of people consider that those final little threads of sounds are like the final breaths in a life, and therefore that it's a musical depiction of death. I don't think it's only that, actually. I think it opens the door to some kind of eternal unknown. And I think that's what the silences give us. And that's why at the end of the Ninth Symphony, I recently did it, and somebody who thought they were clever decided after about 5 seconds to say, oh, I know it's over, so I'm going to clap. And it was so embarrassing for that person, because nobody in the audience wanted to applaud. That piece doesn't end for at least 30 seconds after the last sound, because it's still, something is still going in our minds. It's the most extraordinary thing. So Obviously, it was a piece that I was very keen on having in my last 3 weeks. And with that, I have my dear friend Emmanuel Ax playing a Mozart concerto. And interestingly, my first week, within my first week anyway, he played Chopin second concerto, and then I did Mahler one. So we're 14 years on and a similar pattern.
So Peter, the orchestra was in a rough position when you arrived in 2004. And, you know, you've had 14 years, which is a wonderful length of time to be with one orchestra and to help it grow. It seems to be in a much stronger position now. I'm wondering, over the course of your tenure, what with your time with the TSO has given you the most satisfaction?
I mean, relationships. And that covers everything, right? Because that's also the relationship with the music and the musicians and the way they play, and with the management and all the great friendships I've made through that. And then with our board members and our cherished donors, and with many, many people who buy tickets and come along, and then I'll meet them upstairs. Sometimes when we have those receptions in the lobby, they'll just come up to me and sometimes they tell you a story that's very, very moving. You know, a story that I just, you know, I came from Eastern Europe and I had nothing and I was in Toronto and life was so lonely. And then I discovered the Toronto Symphony and I started coming every month and it's been a lifesaver. And those stories are meaningful and they're sincere. And in the end, that's really why we do what we do, why we believe in it. Because there's a lot of opportunities to experience pain in life. Let's face it, a disappointment of all kinds. But while we sometimes play very tragic music, it shouldn't be a disappointment. It should be a revelation. And so people come to satisfy some kind of hunger, and that's a great privilege as a musician to do that. So there have been so many moments like that I can think of. And now we're getting to the very end of it. It's the thing I will miss the most. It's not just that I love conducting the orchestra. I mean, I will come back. It's starting in a couple of years. But of course, I will miss the people and the players. But it's the relationships and that special bond that you develop over a long period of time.
What was the key, or were the keys to getting the TSO back on a solid footing?
I think people had lost the whole idea of the value of having a symphony orchestra that was excellent in our city. I don't quite know why, because the orchestra always played well, but the orchestra was clearly at times sounded sort of disappointed and disillusioned because they felt unsupported. They couldn't keep a CEO for very long. There were obviously a lot of cuts to their salaries in those early years, around 2000, a little before, a little after. And I think the key really was to bring back the sense of the value of having a wonderful symphony orchestra in the city. And that had a lot to do with simply speaking positively about it, but also giving dedicated and exciting performances, and also speaking. Not everybody loves it. Nobody ever came up to me and said, "I wish you wouldn't talk before a concert, before you conduct." But I'm sure there are people who felt that. But I'm also pretty sure that those people love music so much they didn't need it, and they're still going to come back. But the reason that I did it so often is because I wanted people who would not. You know, they might be on the fence a little bit. Should I have come? What's this going to be like? And a guy walks out, he takes a bow, he turns his back on us and starts conducting, and I don't really know what's going on, and I don't know who he is. And, you know, so I was trying to remove that invisible curtain that can exist. And I think that was very important. But the third thing is the hiring. When you have an opportunity to hire a new player, you have an opportunity to somehow bring new energy and hopefully new optimism.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about this because you made many hires during your time there.
Sure,
how many?
It's over 40. I haven't counted.
About half the orchestra has changed since you came in, and some of those. Well, you've made beautiful hires, especially concertmaster Jonathan Crowe.
Jonathan Crowe is really an absolute blessing to.
And it was Sarah Jeffrey. Was she also? Did she come in with you?
Sarah came in about my third year.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, those two in particular, I find have those are positions that really can define the sound of an orchestra.
Absolutely. There are actually only three principals that I didn't appoint.
Oh wow!
And they're three wonderful players: Paul Meyer, principal second; mm-hmm. Joaquin Valdepeñas, principal clarinet; and Michael Sweeney, principal bassoon. I'd appoint them in a flash. Right. if I'd had the opportunity, but I didn't have that opportunity.
But I'm wondering, you know, when you're dealing with a group of 90 people and you're hiring, say, a section violin, what impact does that one hire have on the orchestra?
That's a very good question, you know, because sometimes when you listen to especially a string player, you're looking for a kind of solidity, a reliability of player, because you know, you need really sound intonation and a good spiccato, good range of bow strokes, and nice expression, yes. You don't want somebody who moves around like a maniac. But you could ask any of them. I was always saying, please listen for the personality. Hire the people who've got real personality in their playing, because that doesn't come from just putting a lot of players together. That comes from the individuals. And you inspire each other. You know, when you're sitting next to somebody, you know, you're in an orchestra and you feel one of 90, but your immediate partnership is with the person on your stand. I don't have to tell you. And you want that to be enjoyable. You want to feel that person is willing to express themselves, willing to even take a little bit of a risk, but also has ears that, you know, so there's a radar that they can feel what's going on in the rest of the orchestra. They're listening to the right line and they're absorbing what's being shown from the podium in a way that makes sense to you. So each player is an incredibly important cog in this mechanism.